Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the meeting to order for March 12th, Labor, Workplace, and Regulated Industries. And I think we have some minutes we need to approve. If I could get a motion to approve minutes from
someone.
Representative Benson moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. First on the agenda this morning is a bill by Representative Erickson. You want to come on up and I'm going to move that chair moves that House File 2736 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. Welcome, Representative Erickson, to the committee this morning, and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2736 is just what it says it is. It's fairly simple. It's a broadband mapping. We're going to try and find out where we have broadband throughout the state, and that will identify the areas that we need to go into. I have Dana McKenzie from the DEED. Department of Economic and Employment or Development, and she's going to do some testifying, and then I'll have a couple of comments afterwards, and then we'll have questions. So go ahead.
Welcome, Dana McKenzie, and if you want to identify yourself for the record and go ahead and say what you wish to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I don't have a lot to say, but just a brief introduction of the office and the role of this project that's being discussed. My name is Dana McKenzie, and I'm the newly appointed Executive Director for the Office of Broadband Development. The office was created in 2013 legislation and placed under the DEED umbrella at that time. Our charge is to help reach the state's goal of achieving high-quality broadband availability for all Minnesota and to work to make sure that to leverage that investment to our to fullest extent for economic, health, education, and social benefits. Since our start 2 months ago, we have been working to establish the office as a resource center for those working on broadband issues across the state, including legislators like yourselves, other policymakers, providers, and community-based groups working to improve broadband infrastructure in their areas. One of the things our office does is to host the mapping and data analysis function that is used to measure current availability and use of broadband infrastructure. This component of the program produces the information needed to make informed and targeted new investments that will be most effective in reaching those state goals that we mentioned earlier. This appropriation is not in the governor's supplemental budget, and therefore DEED is not requesting this funding specifically. DEED is always interested in continuing conversations around broadband development and adoption in the state. I am happy to answer any questions you may have about the need and use of this program.
Very good. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against? Come on up to the table. Welcome, Mr. Christensen. If you want to identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen with the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. Our 46 independent telephone company members have been working with Connect Minnesota and the state through this mapping project since its inception in 2008. We fully support this bill. We would like to see some language in there to tighten it up because we believe that the relationship between the providers and the nonprofit that currently takes that information and creates the maps is important from a competitive standpoint. It's also important for an integrity standpoint for the information. In the 2008 legislation that created the first mapping, there was language in there that specified it needed to be a nonprofit organization with experience working with broadband providers, and we'd be happy to work with the author on that legislation or that language. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much for your testimony. Anybody else in the audience wish to testify? I don't see anyone. Questions from members? Representative Satter?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. And my question, Roger, is that we had this information presented to us a couple of days ago that has a map of Minnesota, and where they have broadband and where they don't, and I'm wondering what the difference is between the study that you're going to do and what we already have.
Maybe Dana could best answer that. And again, identify yourself for the tape. And go ahead, answer.
Dana McKenzie, Office of Broadband Development, Chair, members. That information is actually part of the same work that's being done. It's ongoing and done over time, and that the data set that was used to produce those maps was also created by the current contractor, Connect Minnesota. It's just looking at the data from a slightly different angle than the current state goals.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, that was a very good question. That was that was my opening. So, you gave me another opening. So, explain how the new money will bring greater value. I mean, if you already understand what the need is, I was looking at a report actually from November of 2013 that outlines the how much of the state was meeting the goal. Which, by the way, can either of you what is the goal? And up and down.
Up and down is 10 megs down and 5 megs up.
And okay, so
Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. The one thing that came to light in the Senate hearing, by the way, members, and I think we probably need to have the whole map explained back up. I kind of wondered, and I brought this up last year when we brought it up, that the map that showed Olmsted County with being way below. Can you explain it and maybe confirm if this is correct or not, but that map really is a map that is 10 and 6 and the statute is 10 and 5. So we have a misrepresentation in the map, first of all, okay, because 91% of the customers in Olmsted County are covered by Charter Communications, which blow that away. So the map is wrong in that. And then secondly, we have a map that goes 10 and 6 instead of the 10 and 5, which is the statutory goal. So can you? So I've got a couple of questions. I was making a point. Help me understand why we're going to spend additional money for the value that we already know. We're going to spend more money to find out what we already know, or if we're not proceeding at a great pace, like we continue to hear. What are we going to change? That maybe Olmsted County changed by 1%, and I'm going to spend $500,000 on that.
Ms. McKenzie?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for those questions. And your colleague in the Senate raised a similar issue. And through that dialogue, actually, we did discover that there was a specific issue in your area that is currently being addressed by Connect Minnesota. And in fact, there are issues with a discrepancy in the way the service is advertised versus what you might actually be receiving. And so Bill Hoffman is actually working with the providers in your area to remedy that specific piece. We do also have an additional issue that the program that's currently being undertaken by Connect Minnesota was driven by federal standards. The federal tiers for broadband are different than Minnesota's tiers. And that was simply because the two were being developed in parallel and did not have an opportunity to align themselves. And so that may be something we would want to address down the road. And so, and I also misstated a little bit that the state goal is actually a range. It's from 10 to 20 meg down and from 5 to 10 up. And so we have some challenges there aligning our data gathering. And one of the solutions would be to realign the state goals with the federal tiers. Another solution may be to ask the providers to report at the state goals. Those are some conversations that we might want to have in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members, we heard a bill last week that I wasn't really crazy about, and that was to spend $100 million on data that we're finding out is skewed. So we're looking at areas, and its minimum is 10 and 5, and we were looking at maps that were wrong, essentially wrong. The data says, I don't care how you collect the data. So here we're making decisions about how we're going to pay taxpayers bucks to extend broadband to the folks that are underserved or unserved, but the maps that we're looking at are not even correct. So, you know, here we have another bill in front of us. We're going to pay hard-earned taxpayers' money, and we're not really sure, of course, whether or not we're spending it in the right way. So I would caution you that maybe we need to do a little bit more in that office to find out what we're actually supposed to be trying to do to meet that that goal and that deadline before we sink any more money into it. Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of questions. We started collecting the data, and we had a kind of some static information at a given point in time in 08. Did we ask regions of the state, as they might have had service installed and things, to report back to DEED or to another clearinghouse to collect that information so we wouldn't have to do a second study? It seems like we're kind of going back and looking at what we did 8 years ago or 7 years ago at this point and recollecting the same data to get an update about who's at what level.
Ms. McKenzie?
Mr. Chair, members. 2008 was a little before I was on board, so I apologize. I might not have the facts exactly correct, but my understanding is that the state invested some dollars in a one-time snapshot of what was happening. And then soon after that, the federal SBI program came into being, which gave us ongoing mapping and analysis on a monthly basis since that time. That contract sunsets in December 2014, so that the data that we're looking at is not a static data. It is constantly updated and allowing us to measure progress towards our goals. Does that help answer your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does shed some light on it. I guess I'm wondering what the other $450,000 would be used for, just to continue maintenance as usual, or in collecting that monthly data and providing stakeholders or others with information.
Ms. McKenzie?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that the current proposal involves both continuing the data analysis, gathering and analysis, which is also includes validating the claims of the providers as to coverage and speed, as well as doing household and business surveys to understand our adoption rates, because another piece of the state goal was to rank as a leader in the adoption and use of broadband. And so part of the proposal also involves that work, as well as creating the maps that we are seeing.
Representative Disco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the $450,000, what do you see the burn rate on that before we have to, because it sounds like this is an ongoing process. So the $450,000 seems like it's kind of maybe a stopgap until we get another snapshot in time or continue that.
It is.
Ms. McKenzie?
Mr. Chair, members, you are correct. And again, as coming on board just 2 months ago, the information that's been pulled together is based on past experience of the contract that was done with the federal grant. So it is an informed estimate of what we believe we will need going forward to continue to measure our progress towards the goals. But at this time, it will be a new contract. The old one was with the federal government, and so Minnesota will go through a new process to identify what our needs are and seek a vendor to meet those needs. So at that time, we'll come back with a more informed report.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we talk about measuring broadband, are we talking about measuring the different delivery systems? Because in some areas they may be getting that through satellite and through other, although not on the map as having broadband service under one definition, they may actually be being serviced by another provider that's parallel to what this report's trying to collect.
Ms. McKenzie?
Mr. Chair, members. The reporting is somewhat technology agnostic. However, the benchmark is whether or not it is capable of achieving that state goal of the minimum 10.5. And so various technologies are currently included. In addition to that, more recently, some emphasis has been placed on mobile because we understand the growing importance of mobile. The task force is still debating some of the issues regarding mobile with data caps and not meeting some folks' needs, but that information is also being included in the reporting process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testifier did anticipate my next question. That would be because of telephone service and piggybacking off of internet service on that with tablets and other kinds of devices that you can get on those systems, that we may be under-reporting what our availability is with we're just looking at fiber optic in the ground or some of those kinds of things within different areas. So I think it's important that we look at the whole gamut as technology changes. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Simonson, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, maybe just a couple of comments and then a question at the end. But to Representative Benson's point, you know, I hear what you're saying, and I really think that we're so close to being on the same page on this issue. but this is what we're talking about here is really the future of Minnesota. This is the future of the industry. I think that the value of doing this study is really being understated here. What we really need, Mr. Chair and members, is a roadmap going forward. I don't think anybody in here can honestly say that business and industry and the service organizations don't have technology needs that the state currently isn't meeting. I think there probably could be some discussion and argument about how do we accomplish those things, but I think it's important to put into perspective that we don't have a statewide system right now that supports the needs of Minnesotans, whether that be necessarily on a personal level or on a business level or on a service industry level, and I think that's important to put into perspective. Now, we can certainly argue all day long about, you know, how much money we spend on this or that, but the reality is we've had this governor's task force in place. We have a series of recommendations come out of that process. We've created this new broadband office, which I think is important to the future of Minnesota, and I think that now we need to follow up and give them the tools that they need to really map the future of Minnesota. There's a lot of misinformation out there, and I could draw a map and I could put some numbers on it, and I could convince you or try to convince you one way or the other about what's good and what's bad. And there's a lot of discussion about federal thresholds up, down, and state goals and future needs. And somewhere in the middle of there's a balance. And I think that this is a fluid process, and as we go forward, it's going to continue to change. But I also believe strongly that this particular issue, broadband availability in Minnesota, is the future of Minnesota. So I hope we don't lose sight of that fact. And I think that $450,000 is not an unreasonable ask. I know that there's been numbers floated out there that were higher than that is what we need to accomplish this. So I appreciate that the Representative Erickson, that you're bringing a bill that is reasonable, and I certainly as one would support it. But more importantly, the reason why is that I think it will help give us a roadmap to the future, and I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. So I guess I don't have a question in there, Mr. Chair. That's more of a statement.
Representative Erickson, final thoughts before we move ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've been in had talks with Representative Crenshaw, who's the second author on the bill, and talking about some language to tighten it up for the data privacy. And so we're going to move forward with those conversations and probably have an author's amendment when we get to our next stop. So we're willing to work on this and move forward. Thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The author mentioned that there is some data practices issues on this. Is this going to go to the Data Practices Committee as well as on one of its stops? Or anyone?
Well, it has been requested. You know, we can certainly look at it and talk to you about it.
As I said, bipartisanly, everybody is very concerned about data practices and privacy and those kinds of things. So I think that it would be well warranted to send that to the data practices group. They have worked very well bipartisanly to get stuff done and to protect all of our private information that may be the subject of this particular study.
Okay, but we'll move it on to the Jobs and Economic Development and talk to further on that point. Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. So I'm just curious where the number 450,000 comes from, and it's, you know, for a purpose of funding one or more contracts. It almost seems like you put the donkey before after the cart there. Is there a competitive bid process? Wouldn't it be better to have a plan and then come back and say this is how much money it's going to cost and this is what we need? It just seems kind of vague to just say, oh, yeah, here's $450,000, especially since we already have so much data. You've been collecting data since 2008. We can just keep studying and studying and studying, or we could just ask the counties, hey, who needs broadband? They probably could get in touch with you guys. Maybe some areas are doing just fine. Maybe they don't want it. I don't know. But this just seems so in the air without any real plan, and it's a lot of money. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. The chair renews his motion that House File 2736 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. You're on your way to Jobs and Economic Development.
Thank you,
Ms. McKenzie. Thank you, Representative Erickson. The next bill before us is House File 2373. Representative Moran, are you here? There you are. Come on up. The chair moves that House File 2373 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. And Representative Moran, welcome.
Good morning.
I'm going to move the A2 amendment that puts the bill in the form that you wish. Is that correct, Representative Moran? You want that amendment on?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
The chair moves the A2 amendment to put the bill in the form the representative desires. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is in the form that you wish. Again, welcome, and go ahead with your comments.
Thank you. And again,
comments.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. The purpose of House File 2373 is to begin correcting the gender earning gap in the Minnesota workforce to improve the economic status of women. Minnesota women who are working full-time and year-round still earn only 80% of the earnings of their male counterparts. And for women of color, that number is consistently in the 60 cents plus area, which is not right. Furthermore, the gap is not going away on its own. It has been stagnant for the last 10 years. Minnesota has had pay equity laws on the books for 30 years now, and gender pay equity is now a reality for all state employees and for every city, county, and school district in the state. Now it's time to build on that success by extending pay equity to private businesses that want to contract with the state. This bill builds on both the success with pay equity laws and the state's long practice of requiring these same businesses to submit affirmative action plans in order to bid on state contracts. So we think this bill offers a first step in the process of ensuring that companies doing business with the state are paying women equally for the work of equal value. This bill offers a phase-in process and keeps business data private. It applies only to contracts for goods and services over $500,000 and businesses with more than 40 employees in Minnesota. The basic requirement, which take effect after the first year, is this: a business with more than 40 employees in Minnesota seeking a contract of more than $500,000, $500,000, must have pay equity plans certified by the Commissioner of Human Rights, much the same way the commissioner now approves the company's affirmative action plan. To attain the certificate, the company must submit basic information about its pay equity plan to Human Rights. And so I will stop there and would like to turn it over to my first testifier.
And welcome. And before we move on to testimony, because I see we have about 8 testifiers, I would ask that the testifiers think in terms of limiting their testimony to 2 or 3 minutes, kind of sharpen it up as much as possible, so we have an ample opportunity for members to ask questions later. So with that, welcome, and if you want to identify yourself so we know who you are, and go ahead.
My name is Patty Tangi. I am a volunteer with the Pay Equity Coalition of Minnesota. We are a statewide organization of women's groups, unions, and individuals who care about fair wage setting practices. We support House File 2373. More broadly, we support any measure that helps shift that pesky gender wage gap. This bill replicates the steps we have taken in state and local government to eliminate the wage gap, and that we now know paying employees according to the value of their job as opposed solely on a bias-ridden market-based salary survey helps to eliminate the persistent wage gap. As advocates for women and their families who do not receive the full value of their work in their paychecks, we understand their burden. This is the reason for the bill, and this is the reason why we support it. But the business community talks about their burden and costs of implementing the pay equity program that this bill proposes. I would suggest putting an objective job and pay analysis a system of fairness in place in return for a large amount of revenue subsidized by Minnesota's taxpayer dollars is indeed good for business. Women and their families have been carrying the weight of this wage gap since we started measuring it a few decades ago. We know the gap is caused by many factors, one of which is job segregation, and that means that women's work is paid a women's wage and men's work is paid a men's wage. And that means historically women's work has been undervalued. And this bill calls attention to that discrepancy and shines a light on this unfairness. So we do support House File 2373, and I thank you for allowing me to testify today, and thank you for hearing this bill.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Watkins. Welcome. You want to identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bonnie Watkins. I am also a volunteer with the Pay Equity Coalition. I have 30 years of history with this issue. I worked for the what was then the Council on the Economic Status of Women when the state and local government pay equity laws were passed in the 80s. I then worked for what was then the Department of Employee Relations, training local governments in how to do this, and I wrote the administrative rule on pay equity in 1991. So some days I think I could do this in my sleep, and some days I think I've forgotten everything about it. So thank you for having me. We do have a couple of handouts, and I don't know if we have enough copies, but I don't know if we can distribute those for the committee first and then.
The page will take care of that if you want to just hand it to you there.
Yeah, those three items. There's 20 of each, I think. So hope we'll get close. Sorry. In order to keep it brief, a lot of this is in word form. I will not read it all. I think our two other people have done a great job of describing the basics of what the bill does. So just to emphasize a couple of things, the women of Minnesota really need this. We have really achieved equity in state government and in cities, counties, and school districts, but the vast majority of Minnesota women work in the private sector, so that's why we are hoping to move in that direction. I think the basics is pretty clear about what the bill does. One of these items gives a little more visual representation of what businesses are actually required to do, which I hope will be helpful. So if you want to look at this item that has kind of charts on the back, there's a page that has more pictures. At the top of that, number one, we give a couple examples, and one is a registered nurse and a computer programmer. That in the job evaluation system now used by the state, those jobs would be rated equally, which is actually quite typical for a kind of first job out of college, entry-level professional job, tends to get 238 points. Registered nurses are mostly women. Computer programmers are mostly men. But as you see in the state of Minnesota, the average pay for the computer programmer is about $70,000, and the average pay for the nurse is about $60,000. So there is a big pay gap there that really cannot be explained by the level of skill and responsibility involved. There's another example. The little picture is really historic from 30 years ago about state government. It's helpful, I think, if you look at the little chart on the left, there's tiny asterisks or dots, each of which represents a male-dominated job. And as you can see, there's a very typical pattern in every workplace. The more job evaluation points you get, the higher level of responsibility, the higher the pay. And so somebody's calculated a basic regression line there. But the little Fs represent female-dominated jobs. So before we did pay equity in state government employment, there was this consistent pattern of lower pay for female jobs, even when they had the same or even greater levels of responsibility than the male jobs. So that's really at the core of pay equity. I kind of like the after picture where we don't have a pay-for-point system where everybody who gets 238 points is paid exactly the same, but we don't have that pattern where the female jobs are always paid less, and that is really the intent of this. The last little thing I'll just try to highlight is the information that the businesses would actually need to submit under this bill. In year one, it's really two yes or no questions, a statement of intention to do pay equity, and the total number of male and female employees that they have. So, you know, I really feel they could mostly do that in 5 minutes. The last piece is a little bit more detailed. That's the information they would have to submit after year one. And as you see, it's basically a list of their jobs, how many men and how many women, the minimum and maximum pay, the job evaluation points, and then that's the basis for determining whether there is a pattern of pay inequities. So I hope that's helpful. I can certainly answer questions. There's other material we handed out.
Very good. Thank you, testifiers. You could probably have a seat back in the off to the side there. And did you want to ask a question right now?
Can I hang out over
here? Mr. Chair, I know that I've seen a couple hands on our side, and it may be to the previous testimonies. I do have some questions, but I will defer to some of my members who had hands up just to, for some clarification.
I want to stay there.
Okay. Now, Representative Kiefer, would you... would it be satisfactory for you to wait till all testimony is done before we move on to questions, or did you have something?
Well, I don't know how. Okay, if we want to just listen to all the pros and all kinds and then go into
right.
It, yeah, it's just some stuff directly what she said.
They'll stick around and we'll make sure you get your question answered. Barbara Johnson from Minneapolis City Council. So again, members, we'll just go through testimony here and then make sure everyone sticks around and we'll get our go right to our questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm pleased to be able to speak to you today, and I just wanted to talk very briefly about the City of Minneapolis's experience with the pay equity law. And in listening to the previous testimony, I must admit, I paid attention to this over the years. I'm a registered nurse, and that's what I did before I came on the City Council. But the City of Minneapolis has had extensive experience with pay equity, and we've been successful in implementing the pay equity requirements required by the state. And of course, there was initial anxiety and concern over potential expenditure of resources. We have the system described previously for classifying jobs based on responsibilities and the difficulty of the work done, and then they're assigned a number that is the value of the job using the system. And we require administrators to describe the duties of the job in great detail. And we consider the relationship between the responsibility of the job and the decisions that are made to avoid disparate treatment among our workers. We routinely check to see that we are not discriminating monetarily against our workers with regard to sex. Compliance with the pay equity requirements is an internal barometer for the city. We are a large employer, around 4,000 employees. And so we feel that it hasn't been without effort, but we do this thing across, do this analysis across 600 job titles in the City of Minneapolis, and we think we get the desired outcome, the fair and equitable treatment of all our employees without regard to sex. We send a report every 3 years that is, you know, presented to the City Council, approved, and then sent on to the Office of Management and Budget. And we use an automated web-based reporting process. And the requirements that are in place with this law have been found to not be burdensome. And in 2010, the average cost to comply with pay equity for local governments was 0.1% of payroll. And so we do not compare jobs in the city between other cities. We look internally. So a city manager in Minneapolis is not compared with a city manager in Forest Lake. And we compare the jobs within the jurisdiction and look for patterns of paying women less than men for jobs of comparable work value. In the city, one of the places that we've found early on where we had discrepancy were city clerks, which was a very female-dominated profession, and our custodial employees. And so we have concerns also that if you don't keep up with this reporting, that over time you can slip back into the discriminatory practices if the pay scales aren't closely monitored. And so we're happy to work with you to share our expertise that we've developed over the years with compliance with this law. And we think that other employers will find time and the effort needed to comply with the pay equity standard that treats women equitably in the workplace. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson, for your testimony. We appreciate it. C.P. Johnson, are you here? C.P. Johnson? Doesn't look like it. Okay. How about Ellen Sue Ewald? Welcome.
Thank you.
And just identify yourself, please, for our tape, and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Ellen Sue Ewald, and thank you very much for this opportunity to testify today. I'm here today as a citizen who believes strongly in the importance of ensuring gender equity. My life has been deeply impacted by pay inequity. Let me tell you a bit about me and my situation. I grew up in Hopkins, Minnetonka, Minnesota, and went to Hopkins Lindbergh High School. I did my undergraduate work at the University of Minnesota and graduate work in Norway and at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I moved to Norway on a permanent basis in the 1990s and lived there for more than 20 years. In Norway, I held several positions. But for the last 13 years prior to my return to Minnesota in 2008, I was a business executive and worked with a variety of companies, many with ties to both Norway and to the United States. I've always been interested in research, education, and business. When I was offered a job in Minnesota at the Honorary Norwegian Consulate, helping the Midwest and Norway interface in research and education, including in business ventures, I was absolutely thrilled. I believed this was going to be my opportunity to do something of value for the two countries I love so much. I was hired as an expert in higher education and research. I understood I would be working as part of a team side by side with another employee who was an expert in business development and innovation. The postings with the job descriptions for the two expert positions were very similar. I was wooed to come back to Minnesota with the promise of a parallel and equal position with my teammate. When I was offered the job, I was told that I'd be paid the same as my male peer. Unfortunately, on the same day I was offered a job and told I would be paid the same, my male peer was offered a job at 42% more pay than I was paid. It was clear that this was meant to be kept a secret from me, but I ultimately discovered the truth. I learned that the other expert employee who happened to be a man was not only paid significantly higher salary, but he received better benefits than I did. His spouse and children were covered by insurance, but mine were not. Having lived in Norway for a long time and appreciating the progressive and egalitarian nature of Norwegian society, I was sure the consulate would rectify this unequal treatment. So I brought the pay and benefits disparity to the attention of the Royal Norwegian Embassy in Washington, D.C. Despite the strict prohibition against unequal pay, discrimination, and retaliation against women contained in Norway's own gender equity laws, embassy officials told me that is the way it is and that I should just accept it. I couldn't believe it. And frankly, some days I still can't. Instead of being helped, I was threatened repeatedly. At one point, now the Honorary Consul General told me there would be consequences and someone would likely have to go if I did not stop complaining about unequal treatment. Nonetheless, I continued to raise my concerns throughout the embassy with the leaders and with the leaders in Norway. I felt I had to, not only for myself, but for others working for the embassy. Sadly, my problem was never fixed by the embassy, and I had to resort to litigation. Pay inequities should be avoided or corrected immediately when discovered. No one should have to go through years of fighting to get fair treatment and incurring tons of attorney fees just to be treated the same. It's not fair that a woman like me has to fight so hard and long for justice. I hope this law can help other women get fair treatment right from the start of their jobs. I will not give up. We all have to stand tall for this very important issue. Things do not change without a concerted effort. Feeling discredited, like I was, it's a terrible place to be. Starting out excited about your job and the difference you can make, and then being deflated by knowing that someone who is supposed to be your peer is treated so much better than you are. It feels even worse when in your gut you know that the unfairness is about your gender. Something you cannot change. I didn't fully understand what it felt like to be viewed as unworthy before this experience. It made me question myself in a way I never had before. I asked myself, what's wrong with me? What did I do to make this happen? These kinds of feelings impacted me not only in my work life, but everywhere else as well. It's made it really hard to trust others in the work situation. Suffice to say, no one should have to go through something like I did. You here in the legislature can make a huge difference for women. This law is a great start to bringing other employees online with the state, with what the state does for its own employees. If there had been a law on the books that required my employer to report on how it was doing on pay equity, the embassy would never have been able to get by with paying two similar positions so differently.
Embassy, we'll kind of wrap it up.
Yeah.
Kind
of getting I understand the bill you are considering provides that the business must demonstrate it is in compliance with equitable compensation relationship standards or it is not to be certified. In my case, my employer could not have provided such proof. This type of law can help to ensure that there is pay equity.
Very good. Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate it. And Ms. Rafan? Welcome again, and identify yourself, please, and go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. I do have a letter that I'm hoping the page can distribute to members of the committee.
I'm sure she will. It's right to your right there. Okay.
My name is Melissa Rafan, and I am a partner with the law firm of Dorsey & Whitney, and I'm here in my capacity today as general counsel to the Minnesota Employment Law Council. MELC is a group of some of the state's largest employers. And I'm here to provide their perspective. At the outset, I will say that MELC members are committed to treating women equitably. And it is important to consider that the proposal before the committee is a Comparable Worth Act, not a Pay Equity Act, despite the title. And let me explain the difference. Pay equity protections do exist currently under federal and state law. The concept of comparable worth is very different than pay equity. It is really an apples to oranges comparison. Comparable worth involves creating a new job evaluation system to analyze jobs in a manner which does not include market factors. The system is not used in the private sector because it simply doesn't fit. No other state has comparable worth in the private sector because it recognizes that it doesn't fit. The private sector's setting of compensation is based on a very complex set of factors, including individuals' experience, tenure, education, and market data. What will it take to attract individuals? In many instances, the components of compensation in the private sector are different. So the point really is that this is a comparable worth statute, not a pay equity statute. The next point is that it is unnecessary because pay equity, paying two people who do this same job the same salary, unless you can explain it by reasons other than gender, is already protected under four existing laws. Two federal laws, Title VII and the Equal Pay Act, two state laws, Minnesota Human Rights Act and the Minnesota Own Equal Pay Act. Imposing this comparable worth analysis or system, evaluation system, in the private sector would be anti-competitive. By imposing the costs only on Minnesota employers, the bill essentially puts Minnesota companies at a competitive disadvantage. And when Minnesota companies lose work, Minnesotans lose jobs. And finally, there are increased costs. It's not as simple as answering a couple of questions. It is actually involves the design of a complex system to analyze a numbers of different jobs and would significantly increase the cost of doing business, which would be passed on to increased prices for goods and services, which would be passed on to taxpayers and employees. Thank you, and I'm available for questions.
Very good. Yeah, if you'd stick around, it'd be great. Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Larson? Welcome, and identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Our organization shares the same concerns that Ms. Rafan outlined. I would just like to add a couple of additional points. As she mentioned, our companies, I represent about 100 the largest employers in Minnesota, not all of whom would be affected by this law. They don't all contract with the state. But they all have systems in place to ensure that they comply with the existing pay equity laws. But as Melissa mentioned, this is comparable work, which is a very different concept. I also wanted to point out, and you're going to hear from the chamber in a minute, but this proposal would affect hundreds of Minnesota companies, many of which aren't represented by me or by the chamber or anybody else in this room. They probably don't even know this bill exists. But the vendor list provided by the Department of Administration that shows the number of companies that meet this $500,000 level is almost 1,200 companies. And so there's a lot of companies that would be impacted by this. And that list doesn't include employers like health plans, hospitals, nonprofits, who also we think would be impacted by this proposal. The proposal references the comparable worth statutes and rules that currently apply to local governments in the state. And those statutes and rules are nearly 40 pages long. I printed them out. It's a stack this thick. That would be new rules that would now apply to private companies that want to contract with the state. And as Ms. Rafan mentioned, imposing a new employee compensation system that was developed for the public sector and basically trying to shoehorn that or overlay it onto private companies' compensation systems is really troublesome. We have employees all over the world, let alone in Minnesota and other states, and so trying to fit something that's intended for Minnesota employees to all of our employees would be very complicated and burdensome. And finally, I think the point needs to be reiterated that our employers do ensure that they pay people fairly based on gender, but we also take into account the market. And the example given of, I think in one of the handouts, of maybe a computer or an emergency medical technician and a clerk senior teller that may under this system have the same number of points, in their example, they were paid differently. And there may be reasons that have nothing to do with discrimination why those two jobs are paid differently. There may be less people that want to be an emergency medical technician than want to be a senior teller or clerk. And in the market, that means you might have to pay them more. It may have nothing to do with gender discrimination. So we would ask you to consider the concerns and to not support this bill as written. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And then Ms. Kadan, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. Kadun? Welcome, Ms. Kadun. Do you have something to pass out there? We'll get the page for you.
Busy. Yes.
She'll pass that out. Go ahead and identify yourself and go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Kadun. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, an organization of 2,300 businesses across the state of Minnesota. 80% of our members are 50 or less, have employed 50 or less. We are here to oppose this bill, House File 2373. As was mentioned, we do believe there are adequate remedies to deal with discrimination. We do not tolerate discrimination of any kind in the workplace. And what's being handed out is just a sheet regarding the EEOC, the federal laws that deal with equal pay and discrimination, just for to see that there's some adequate remedies. And it was mentioned also state law as well that deal with discrimination in the workplace. What I want to focus my comments on is really the issue of for the small and mid-sized companies. This current bill is written, does apply if you have 40 or more employees in Minnesota. So realize for some small and mid-sized companies, they do not have the HR functions and capabilities. A lot of times it's just a person who has this as a part-time role in the company. This does create a real cumbersome, complex process for companies that employ in Minnesota. The other point to make as well is it applies if you have Minnesota employees. It does not apply if you're a vendor from out of state. So once again, you are making Minnesota companies to have this fixed cost of doing business in the state. That would make them less competitive when competing for contracts with out-of-state vendors. So I want to make sure that point gets across as well. And also mention what was mentioned by Jill Larson as well, which is that market force issue. This is imposing this blunt tool for private sector, and realize that this private sector market does not work that way. It really is driven by market forces for pay compensation. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for that testimony. I appreciate it very much. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against the bill? Please step forward. I don't see anybody, so I'm going to open up to questions. And Representative Kiefer, you're first on the list. And
thank you, Mr.
We'll bring up whoever you need to talk to.
Okay. To Bonnie, sorry, I don't know your last name right
now.
To
Watkins.
Okay, thank you. You know, the first thing that struck me in your testimony was you really ignored supply and demand. And I think the last testifier kind of mentioned that different jobs pay more because they're in demand more. And so I think we're totally ignoring that in your statistics. And then I think a lot of this has already been said, too, but I'll reiterate it because I'm having notes here, and I was writing it before I even heard them say it. But how do you compare the different skills? You know, there's all sorts of things you got to take into consideration, their education. How much debt did they have to incur to get that education? What are their job responsibilities? What's the job hours, and are the hours flexible? I was curious on how this law is going to address states that do interstate commerce or international commerce. I guess I could let you address a few of those first, Mr. Chair.
All right. Again, Ms. Watkins, if you want to
sure, thank
give it a
you,
shot,
Mr.
Go ahead.
Chair and Representative Kiefer. Let me see where to start. Supply and demand really is the way jobs are often paid now in the private sector. I think that's this law would not prohibit using things like the market to set pay. But, you know, the testimony about how we already have all kinds of great anti-discrimination laws and we don't discriminate against women cannot explain why we still have that huge gap in how women are paid. I guess it's just difficult to explain that. We need another factor to take a second look at how pay is set. And this bill says that a primary, not the only consideration, but a primary consideration would be the value of the work as measured by skill, effort, responsibility, and working conditions. These systems that measure this are not a radical feminist plot. They've been around for about 150 years. The system that the state of Minnesota uses, Hay Associates, is widely used in the private sector, widely respected. None of these systems are pure science, but they are fairly objective. So, for example, measuring the level of responsibility of a job compares specific things like how many dollars of budget do you manage? Sometimes how many employees do you manage? What happens if things go wrong in your job? So they are really a balancing act, and the piece of the balance that I think has been missing is the internal equity. You know, people know that usually supervisors are paid more than people they supervise, so you need some way of looking within a company as opposed to what does the guy down the street pay for jobs. So I guess that's the best I can explain about supply and demand is not going to go away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me we're fighting a perception problem. And that's what I think is the underlying issue, is how are women perceived? I'm just getting that sense. And I'm wondering, what is this message, and are we really going to change the paradigm with the message that this bill and other bills are bringing? In fact, we heard several bills last week about women's issues, and I kept thinking to myself, these bills are putting us backwards in time. We are losing the respect that we so dearly want in the workplace by bringing up all these special bills for women and almost making us look like whiners. To the author of the bill, Rep. Moran, Mr. Chair, can I ask Rep. Moran
sure.
a question? Thank you. Thanks, Rep. Moran. How would this bill affect, like, the bonding project that 3M has to build that multi-million dollar east side of St. Paul Research Center that I think was in the bonding bill maybe a year or two ago. How would that affect them and their cost, and are they going to have to jump through all kinds of hoops now if this bill were to be passed? Do you have any idea what the additional cost would be?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
Representative. One thing that we do know when we look at the pay rates and how I would say women are devalued for the work and expertise that they bring to the table and comparable to men is of equal value. And we have not seen that in the workforce. As I stated before, women are paid at 80 cents of the compared to men, with women of color being paid 60 cents, 62, 64, 69 cents. And to me, that is a clear indicator that there is some discrepancy based on the work that women bring to the workforce. And I would say, in looking in regards to your question, I don't think there's hurdles that needs to be jumped through. I don't think that is a huge burden. It is different than what has currently been done in the private sector. But 85% of the work of women who are in the workforce are working for the private sector. So my hope is that what this will bring to the private sector is women, and I am just in awe of the women who come to testify, because I think this is a beautiful thing. It just shows the value of what we bring to the table. And as I see women after women come to testify here, tells me that they are in position of power and authority, which is a good thing. And we need to continue along that path, but we also need to be paid at that same value and at that same worth. And my hope is that this bill will help that process, because currently, based on the facts and the data and the statistics, it has not been done.
Go ahead, Resident Keeper.
Chair, follow up. Okay, I guess my specific question was, does anybody know, and maybe the author doesn't, but maybe someone in the audience knows, could give us an idea of a bill like this, how would it affect some of these bonding projects? They're multi-million-dollar projects, so they're going to be tied into state dollars. How is that going to affect the cost of those projects? And there's got to be a cost, because there's going to be a demand on redoing the way they do human resources. They're going to have to, there's going to be mandated reports and such. I don't know if their systems are ready to accommodate that. If there's someone from the business community that could possibly answer it, just to give us an idea. And if they say, oh, well, there's absolutely no cost, it's no problem.
Well, let Ms. Watkins go ahead and take a shot there. If someone else wanted to respond, they're welcome.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer, this is where we really do have 30 years' worth of experience with the cost factor, in addition to lots of other things. For 1,500 local governments, all separate employers with their own compensation systems, very few of whom had this kind of system in place when we first passed these laws back in the 1980s, so we really didn't know what it was going to cost, both to change their systems and if they found gender-based inequities, to correct the inequities, to give raises to the women who had earned them. The total cost in the beginning when all this was put in place averaged 2% to 4% of the total annual payroll for each of those separate employers. It varied a little bit between cities and counties and so on. Once that was changed, the cost now, I believe the person from the city of Minneapolis said it's 0.1% of payroll to correct the, maybe one new inequity appeared in the past year as new jobs were created. The administrative costs, again, this is why we list what it is. I would think any HR person out there, especially with these huge companies, could produce a list of the job titles, the number of people doing those jobs, how they currently pay. The one missing piece, apparently for some, this is why we ask whether they need help with that or not, is the job evaluation system. Do you have a system like that in place? We are told that many employers already do have such a system, and maybe they can easily apply it and find out that they don't have any inequities and they're done. If they don't have a system, that's why we ask in the first year, would you like training on this? There actually is a system that the state makes available for free that they could piggyback on. So resources are available to them, and the cost is minimal.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving me a long leash here. I'm glad you mentioned the local governments, because for the last 4 years, my local government has been begging me to have this pay equity mandate removed. He says it's archaic, and we already pay equally. It's all very transparent, and there's no need for that cumbersome report. He says it takes a lot of extra man hours and distracts them from doing the business that the city should be doing for its citizens. So I just wanted to make that point, too, that is on their legislative agendas to actually repeal that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Udlum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think this bill is a well-meaning bill. I think we all support gender pay equity, and it's an important issue before this legislature. But I think a couple of points were well taken, and gender pay equity is already protected under federal law and at least two other Minnesota state laws. And being that our governor is talking about an uncession here and getting rid of redundant laws and things like that, this seems to me to be a law that we probably don't need. That being said, I guess I'd like to direct my question to Representative Moran. The way I'm reading this under the Certificate of Pay Equity Compliance Deal 1.16, the Commissioner of Human Rights will essentially have a veto power under state contracts with the way this thing is written. If a contractor does not comply and the commissioner doesn't sign off on this deal, he's going to have the absolute power. Is that correct?
Representative Moran?
Mr. Chair, Representative, first I would like to address the laws that's currently on the books that one of the testifier paid pass out, and it talks about pay equity. You know, the equal pay equity requires that men and women are paid the same, but it also states that if an individual alleges a violation of the EPA, they can go directly to court. And what this is costing one of the testifiers is money. There's a cost to that. It's not free to do that. And so often women who are head of household, who are taking care of families and running a household and working in the workforce, that can be very burdensome. And a lot of times they don't have the resources to go to court. This will eliminate that barrier. This will eliminate that process of having to take your employer to court. So, and I'm sorry, please repeat the last part of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the gist of my question was, under this bill, particularly on 1.16, line 1.16, reading this, the Commissioner of Human Rights, if he doesn't approve the business plan, essentially will have veto power over these contracts. So if a contractor submits a plan, commissioner doesn't like it, and like Representative Kiefer said, maybe that contractor is building 3M's new research center, the commissioner has veto power over this. Is that what your bill says?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Moran.
Representative, I would try at this, and then I'm going to pass it over to Mrs. Watkins. But currently, we have affirmative action plan in place, which the commissioner has the same power to do that. And this is just another place where he would have the ability to look at the plan and make a decision whether or not it meets the standards to which it needs to meet. But I would also pass that over.
Ms. Watkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, in a sense, yes, the commission has that sort of power over affirmative action plans right now. If there's a bad affirmative action plan that doesn't treat men and women and people of color, et cetera, fairly, yes, that's why these things were put in place, because we don't want our tax dollars to go to employers that don't treat people right. And in the sense of being, you know, kind of veto based on nothing, I don't think that's in here at all. There's, to me, a very careful and very important definition of equitable compensation relationships, and that phrase "not consistently below the pay for male-dominated jobs" is really important. I think actually it sets the bar pretty high, and again, there's a lot of statistical stuff involved with this in the local governments, but basically, if you had 10 jobs and women were underpaid in 2 out of 10 cases, you would still pass that test. But, you know, you just cannot, every single time there's a female-dominated job, pay less for it. So it's those really outlier extreme cases that are not caught by the equal pay for equal work laws and that would potentially trigger this.
Representative Uglum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Watkins. However, if the commissioner does not issue the certificate of pay equity, that contractor would not get that job. Is that correct?
Ms. Watkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, yes, there are several things about good faith effort written into this as well that would provide some opportunities for the business to work with the commissioner, for the commissioner to provide technical assistance to, you know, really help them, because the goal would be to help everybody be in compliance.
One last question.
Mr. Chair, yes. Yeah, that brings up an interesting point. This bill provides no redress, really, for grievances for a contractor or anybody else in business other than the technical assistance. It doesn't provide a methodology for a company to turn around and get their contract reinstated other than the technical part of things. And the other thing that I'm very, very concerned about is we heard that there were at least 1,200 companies that could be affected. I suspect that it's much, much more than that. So if we're going to have in the Department of Human Rights somebody overlooking at least 1,200, possibly more contracts, what's the fiscal cost of that? How many new employees are going to be in the Human Rights Department looking at and checking and generating these pay equity agreements? Two questions.
Yes.
Ms. Watkins.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum. The there is a fiscal note being prepared. And we don't know how many people it's going to take. I would like to clarify, just because there are 1,200 companies on that list from the Department of Administration does not mean they would all fall under this. So, for example, you need to have more than 40 employees in Minnesota. And when it comes to, for example, the pretty large number of consulting firms, I think many of them probably are not that many employees. So it's really hard to know at this moment how many there would be, but that really is, frankly, Human Rights is going to need to figure out what it takes and let you all know that.
Representative Uglum?
And could you address the redress of grievances?
Ms. Watkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, I am not sure I know how to respond to that. I'm sure there is some legal process by which somebody who is unfairly denied a state contract can complain about it.
I didn't say that.
But I guess I don't have a great response to that. There's a lot of process before it would come to that is all I can say at the time.
Mr. Chair, just a conclusion.
Representative,
well, like I stated in the beginning, pay equity is very important to this state and to this country. But this bill here, it's got a lot of holes in it. It's going to have to go through the process. I think you better take a look at a lot of things, and anybody that represents small business in this state has got to be very, very concerned about the burdensome reporting requirements, the point system, and everything else. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mason?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to make a couple of comments. First of all, I know the difficulty it takes in running a company and the problems in dealing with a number of issues, but one of the members had mentioned something about perception. And for one thing, many professions require people to take ethics courses. And yet, one of the most important top 150 events listed by the Minnesota Historical Society is the Wilmer 8 strike in 1977. 8 women went on strike because they wanted equal pay for equal work. Essentially, like one woman was training the new young men that were coming in who were getting much more money. So, and I think it's pretty clear. Pay, there are so many inequities that are still happening today. We need to be doing something to address it. This has to do with its ethical behavior. and it's got we've got to be taking into supply, more into account than just supply and demand. Somewhere we need to make people feel that they do are respected.
Very good. Representative Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you had requested testifiers to do, I'll also dispense with questions and things that, that others have talked about. But I think there's two things that we need to look at. One is a fact check on what a couple testifiers had said, and the other with Ms. Watkinson. Ms. Watkinson, you said that the Department of Administration has 1,200 vendors on their list. I'd like to probe that a little bit just to make sure that I understand this. Those 1,200 have 40 or more, or 50 or more employees? That's the total list? That's all vendors, Minnesota and other? I just need some clarification and quantifying of that.
Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll, first of all, the Department of Administration, I believe, is here and can maybe respond, but it's not, my understanding is they did not have the ability to sort by number of employees. They could sort by contracts of $500,000 or more. So it's not a perfect fit with who would be covered by this bill, and it's just a factor of what kind of information is available.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to have the Department of Administration come down. This is the crux of the law that we're looking at and bill that we're debating here today as to just how many vendors I'd like to know are domiciled in the state of Minnesota and how many provide services to the state of Minnesota that would be domiciled somewhere else who would, in essence, get a skate on this law because they would not meet the definition, which could cost Minnesotans in the long run some jobs.
It looks like someone's coming down to address your question. Do you want to identify yourself, sir, and go ahead and if you heard the question correctly?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kent Allen. I work with the Department of Administration. Ms. Watkins' statement is correct. We were asked by supporters and opponents of the bill for what information we did have that relates to the number of vendors that may have obligations under the law. And based on the data that we could get from our systems, what we produced for all the interested parties was the list of companies that had contracts that were or estimated to be over $500,000. And that list included 424 contractors that were supplying goods and services and 690 contractors that were providing professional and technical services. We didn't have any way to sort that by whether they're Minnesota businesses, whether they have 50 employees or more in the state of Minnesota. So this is sort of the largest potential pool. And based on what we do know, it would be considerably smaller than that based on the several limiting factors in the bill.
Very good. Representative Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is intriguing. I'd like to probe this a little bit more with the department. In your procurement, do you have certain services that the state purchases where there's a limited number of providers for that service where the state could end up in a situation under this proposed law that they would no longer be able to fill that service because a contractor or service provider doesn't meet the criteria and the state of Minnesota would run without those critical services?
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is a possibility. Sometimes get a limited number of responders when we issue a solicitation, and if companies chose not to fulfill these requirements and preferred to not pursue Minnesota state contracts, that could open that we see.
Representative Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of other questions based on your testimony. Can you, for the committee's benefit, share some of the areas that the department currently has trouble in getting vendors or bidders or suitors for state work that you're having a tough time getting competitive pricing right now or finding an adequate vendor?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd be hard-pressed to give you any names or categories right now. I'd be happy to talk with some of our staff and come back or shoot over a list of some examples.
Representative Driscoll?
Mr. Chair, for the committee's benefit, I would like to have that available, and if you could send that in an email to all committee members. I think that's an important part of the scope of this law or proposed law that we're looking at, and its immediate and long-term impact on your ability to procure goods and services that are needed by the state of Minnesota. I also said, Mr. Chair, if I could, that I wanted to fact check something. If I have this correct, then I'm going to ask Representative Moran. She said that currently local units of government and others submit to the Department of Human Rights their comparable worth. Did I get that correctly?
Representative Moran?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. I was talking in relationship to affirmative action plan.
Okay.
Representative Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I did write down that you had said that that's where it was going. So either I misunderstood your comments or they weren't clear enough for me to be able to get that. Yeah. And Council President Johnson said that the comp worth stuff is submitted, that they have, gets submitted to MMB, and I guess I would like to know why we would choose MMB for government entities to submit the proof that there's compliance, but we would require private industries to go to a different agency of government to provide, in essence, the same kind of proof.
Ms. Watkins?
Mr. Chair.
Again, members, we have one bill left, so if we could wind her down
sure,
here.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, that was actually a question when we were first drafting this bill, is to keep this concept in the MMB where it is right now because they have long experience with doing similar work, or human rights where they've been doing the affirmative action compliance thing. And in the end, the decision was that human rights works with this audience, this customer group, that human rights has been working for many years with businesses that seek to contract with the state for purposes of affirmative action. So it just seemed like they would be more familiar with the customers that use this process.
Representative Driscoll?
Mr. Chair, this will be my last, it's more of a comment. So what I'm hearing is that we have two different sets of rules depending upon who you are. If you're government, you get one set of rules, and if you're the private sector, you get a different set of rules. But yet this bill attempts to try to remove barriers and put equality out there. I just find that kind of ironic baked into to the bill here today.
Good. Last word, Representative Moran?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is not an anti-business bill. We know the value that businesses bring to the state of Minnesota, and we value that. This bill is more about pay equity, because most women, 85%, work in the private sector where the earning gap persists. Minnesota is in need of a new pay equity law. Minnesota women who work full-time year-round earn this much in relationship to the earnings of a white male. White women earn 80%. Native American women, 66%. Asian American women, 64%. African American women, 62%. And Hispanic women, 56%. This is clear inequities. It is truly unfair. And we're asking businesses who want to come to the state for business that they are creating a pay equity plan in place so that we can begin to see the value of women who are head in household be as comparable and up to par as white men in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Moran. With that, the chair moves that House File 2373 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill moves on to civil law. We have one last bill, Representative Sundin, if you want to.
We have House File 2767 in front of us today. Representative Johnson moves that House File 2767 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection, Finance, and Policy. I see an amendment as well.
I'd like to move that as well, Mr. Chair.
It is a motion to add the amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, motion prevails. Chair Johnson, to your bill.
I'd also like to make an oral amendment to delete Section 1 and Section 2, since the amendment that I put on makes those sections no longer relevant.
You heard the motion. Questions to that motion on the oral amendment?
Basically, Mr. Chair, we're just down to the repealer.
Yeah, thank you. Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you.
Members, Mr. Chair, what's repealed then are essentially two things. One is in sectional law, this is the unsectioned bill for telecom. The multi-party line telephone service, that's what's referred to in section 237.068. That is now obsolete, the language for that. It repeals language stating that after October 31st, 1993, no telephone company may offer or provide multiple party line telephone service to more than two subscribers per line unless otherwise approved by the PUC. That's no longer necessary. The second item is section 237.44-45, and that's telegraph line regulation enacted in 1905, and that's also obsolete, except perhaps in Chaska. So I'm open for questions. We have the commissioner here as well.
Does the commissioner intend on testifying today?
I could say a few words. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The as you know, this is the governor's unsession initiative. The reason I'm here on this, and it's been skinny down to basically very uncontroversial items, is because this is what's remaining is one of my most favorite provisions that we've gone through in terms of unsession. When we looked at our laws and a staff member ran into my office saying, do you know we still regulate the telegraph companies in Minnesota? I was a bit amazed and shocked. But at the same time, they're completely unnecessary. There were some other provisions we thought were unnecessary, but we didn't want controversy or we didn't want to propose that. So in essence, this is one piece of our department's overall initiative on unsession. We looked through, you know, about 2,900 pages of chapter laws, and it's clearly these are clearly unnecessary. So I just want to thank the committee for taking this up today and the author.
Thank you. Commissioner, could you identify yourself officially for the record?
Sorry, Mike Rothman, Commissioner of the Department of Commerce.
Okay, thank you. Any other testifiers in the room? Okay, we have one question to the author. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know, Mr. Chair, I guess I'll say it this way. You and I and Mike Beard and Speaker Thiessen and some others have been concerned for 10 years, 8 years about telecom reform. And maybe I'll address it, Mr. Commissioner. This would be a good time, if you can do this in the end session, to get together with some of the interested parties and take out more. I know you were trying to avoid controversy. I don't think that's possible. If we want to reform the telecom statutes, we've talked about this for years, and I think we could do it, and we need to look at 237, and it could be really skinnied down. There's a lot of things in 237 we could get rid of, so I would encourage the author and the department to get together with the interested parties here and see if there's more things we can take out, and it might not be entirely painless, and I know that we're kind of at a short session, but as we know, this needs to be reformed, and we've talked about it for years. So that's just my 2 cents worth. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hoppe. Chair Johnson.
Just to piggyback on what Representative Hoppe says, I totally agree. And frankly, Representative Hoppe, I think this is something we'll be doing in the interim, given the time crunch. And I'm looking forward to your help on this. And it's a notice to the people in the telecom world that there are going to be some changes. Not everyone's going to like it. We are going to address 237, and we're going to come in with something next year that I think we're going to find more amenable to everybody here. So I look forward to working with Representative Hoppe on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sounds good.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Any final words on this? Or was that it?
That was it.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody in the audience?
That's what it's been. Representative Johnson moves that House File 2767 as amended be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection, Finance, and Policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Thank you.
Good to see you. Everyone okay?
That concludes our business today. Thank you. We are adjourned.